Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, with the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership, dedicated to offering virtual lectures with speakers who inspire. More at viterbo.edu/ethics.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many people in Wisconsin and around the country are having trouble getting access to mental health care. Our guest says psychiatric mental health nurses could be a big part of the solution. First, we've been hearing about a Republican plan in the legislature to increase funding for Wisconsin schools by $500 million. That's quite a bit less than what Governor Evers says he wants, so the final number is up in the air. But teacher salaries and other school funding challenges in Wisconsin and around the country have been factors contributing to a growing trend of American teachers seeking opportunities in other countries. Aaron Richards has written about this previously for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now as national education reporter for USA Today. She joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's start on the demand side. Apparently, you write there's a growth in what's called international schools around the world that's creating demand for these teachers. Tell us about those schools.
Right. These are private schools located overseas. They used to be havens for the children of foreign diplomats, state workers who are in foreign assignments overseas, or maybe the children of business people that have foreign assignments. But they've been growing, especially over the last 10 years or so, as more and more foreigners who live in these countries want to send their kids to an American-style school. These are private schools. They're in the area. So increasingly, these schools are not only serving American students living abroad, they're also serving students who live in that particular country. So they're a private school, usually pretty well-resourced. They charge tuition, and it's another option for local students to have an American-style education.
And they want American teachers, apparently.
They do, and part of that makes a lot of sense, right? If you're going to offer an American-style education all in English, you would like to have teachers there teaching English. A lot of parents are seeking this education because they think it will increase their children's chances of understanding the system and having a better shot at getting into an American university. And so these schools are very hungry for well-trained American educators who are willing to move overseas. And to get them there, they are willing to offer them quite a few benefits.
And you spoke to a bunch of teachers who have done this. What kind of things do they say about why they were going abroad to teach at these schools?
Many teachers talked about the fact that they had a sense of adventure. They had some interest in going and working and living overseas anyway. But a lot of them also said they were looking for the kind of respect that they think the teaching profession deserves. So many of them didn't realize that would be such an important factor to them until they got there. But there's also some other things. These international schools may not pay fantastic, but a lot of them cover your housing as a teacher. If you have children, you can send your children to the school you're teaching at for free, which is potentially, you know, up to $18,000 to $20,000 of tuition for your children to go to a private school abroad. So for many teachers, those are really attractive benefits that they wouldn't necessarily get if they stayed in the United States.
Talking to Aaron Richards from USA Today about a trend of teachers from the United States finding jobs at international schools around the world, finding them preferable to their options in some cases in the U.S. You talked to one teacher, Aaron, who said there's a hunger for the what had been the standard model of American education in countries around the world, but not so much in the United States. Can you talk about what you heard from that teacher?
Well, this is coming from the perspective that you've been seeing and hearing about around the country where, I mean, this is the same sentiment that's been underscoring the teacher walkouts that we've seen in other states and strikes over teacher pay and also just competition from charter schools, this whole idea that the teaching profession is sort of under siege in a way, or at least underfunded in America. And we all know, both here and abroad, that American schools are havens for creativity despite the numerous types of restrictions that we have on public schools here or the kinds of standards that schools have to meet. There's still a lot of creativity here. And of course, American universities are highly sought after. And so that I think the sentiment that that particular teacher, whose name is Nate Bowling, and he's a popular educator in Washington State, what he was getting at was, look, this kind of education that we're providing to students is sought after around the world. And isn't it ironic that I feel like I need to leave my school in Washington State to go teach the way I want to teach in a private school overseas? And in many ways, the difference here, too, is that we're talking about public schools in America, and these are private schools overseas who, that don't have the same, you know, they don't have to work with unionized teachers. They don't have to administer standardized test scores or, sorry, standardized exams every year. So there is some more freedom to teach in these schools purely because they are private and tuition-based.
Yeah, a lot of the teachers you talked to mentioned autonomy, that they have more control in their classroom of what they do than they would in most American schools.
Right. And I, from what I saw, I visited one of these schools in Quito, Ecuador, and what I saw was a pretty low ratio between students and teachers. So in most classrooms, there were no more than 15 to 18 students, and there was usually one teacher and also an instructional aide of some kind, sometimes a third teacher as well, or an assistant. And also there's more resources in these schools. There's I think the school I visited in Quito had probably three college advisors for students and families, which was also something that a lot of schools here can't afford to provide at the high school level anymore. So those are just some of the resources that I saw there.
Let's bring on a caller. Anne is with us in Green Bay. Anne, hi.
Hello. I have a friend whose niece and her husband have been doing this for like 30 years. They've been to Taiwan and India and China and Japan. And not only do they get free housing, but they have people that come and do their laundry. They have maid service. They have cooks. They have chauffeurs. Their kids go to school for free. And they get to travel whatever country they're in while they're there. So they're not only getting, not only educating their people, but they're getting an education in the culture and what goes on in the country as well. So it's really a win-win, and I wish I would have known about this 40 years ago. Mm. I would have done the same.
And thanks a lot for sharing that story. And she said the people she's talking about have been doing this for three decades. This has been going on for a while, and you wrote about this back, I think, in 2012, Aaron, but it's really picking up now, it sounds like.
It is. There's more than 10,000 international schools around the world now. I think the last time I wrote about this 7 or 8 years ago, it was certainly fewer than that. Estimates are that the total number of staff in these schools is probably about 500,000 people now worldwide. There is definitely growth. There is definitely an appetite for it. But to speak to what your caller said as well, a lot of teachers who have been in this field for a long time talk about it being, sort of you're in the network of international schools teaching. Many teachers only stay with a school for between 2 to 4 years. Often when you move on, often to schools in Asia where the pay is higher, there's kind of this movement around the world of educators, which I found really interesting because in America, we often talk about the concern about teacher turnover in schools. And in a lot of these places, teachers were only staying for maybe the course of two contracts, which would be a total of about 4 years or so.
Thanks for that call, Anne. And Aaron, you mentioned the spirit of adventure earlier, which would make me think of, okay, this is maybe somebody, a new teacher, maybe even just out of school. You saw a lot of veteran teachers choosing this path.
I did. And one thing to note is that many of these schools are looking for teachers with at least a little bit of experience teaching in American schools. Often not a lot. I knew some younger teachers who'd only done maybe 2 or 3 years here in the States or in Wisconsin before they left to go teach abroad. But there certainly are a lot of veteran educators. I think the last time I wrote about this a number of years ago, I talked to at least one principal in Wisconsin who was actually retiring and then moving to the Cayman Islands to lead a school there, an international school there.
So is this trend expected to continue? Or are we going to see more of these schools and then more need for American teachers in other countries?
Every consultant that I talked to for this story said there's no signs of any slowdown. In fact, the growth of international schools has been at about between 5% and 7% a year, which just means that more and more staff are you know, being requested. One word of warning, I did get a little bit of feedback from this article, and there were a few teachers who had been teaching in the international school circuit, and they said that they'd moved back in part because they weren't protected by the same union labor laws. They weren't necessarily, they didn't always feel that they could complain about the way a school operated, lest it, you know, come back to bite them. This world of international teachers is pretty small. So there are some concerns there that teachers should fully check out before they decide to, you know, leap and take one of these positions overseas.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards. She covers national education stories for USA Today. And we talked with her about teachers from the U.S. moving abroad to work at international schools. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates roughly 46 million people around the country experience some form of mental illness annually. Some experts predict that in the coming years, the country could see a shortage of 250,000 mental health care professionals, leaving people without the care they need. Psychiatric mental health nurses could potentially help fill that gap. As specialized nurses, some can diagnose and treat patients without physician oversight. However, Wisconsin's not among the states that allow that to practice. Our next guest says that's an issue worth addressing, especially since a recent report says just 19% of Wisconsin mental health care patients have their needs met. Gail Stern is the president of the American Psychiatric Nurses Association and has been a psychiatric nurse for more than 35 years. Gail, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, can you talk a little more before we get into the specific role of the psychiatric mental health nurse? Can you talk a little more about the challenges in finding mental health care access in the country?
Oh, my goodness. So as you just said, in Wisconsin, it's like 19% of the health, mental health needs are met. So what we have seen is, well, there's certainly a decrease in psychiatrists and people going into psychiatry. Some of that historically has been related to stigma, related to the mental health vocation, if you will, or the mental health patient, the patient who experiences mental health. So there's not been a dialogue around that kind of care. And so the providers of the individuals with mental illness often are, shall we say, less admired than the other professions or other specialties in medicine. So I think that's part of it, and I'm happy to say that some of that is changing. I think there's much better awareness and openness. But part of this report that we put together is to try to invite and to intrigue individuals who are currently in nursing or who might be considering nursing to also consider psychiatric mental health nursing. Go ahead.
A lot of people might not know. I'll put myself out there. I didn't know that there was this specialty of psychiatric mental health nursing. Could you talk about what kind of training goes into that and the role these nurses play?
Sure. And I just want to mention, too, that the psychiatric mental health nurses actually represent the second largest group of behavioral health professionals in the United States. So I think we follow social workers. So what the preparations, there are two levels. There's the RN preparation for psychiatric mental health nursing, and then there's advanced practice nursing. So you go to nursing school, which is three or four years. I know it's kind of confusing, but you become eligible to sit for licensure as an RN. Once you accomplish that, you then are usually trained on the job with a fairly extensive orientation to be able to care safely and effectively for psychiatric patients or people with psychiatric disorders. The advanced practice nurse gets a master's or often now even a doctorate in psychiatric nursing and does extensive, shall we say, clinical time in terms of training and in educating about illnesses and the prescribing medications or the psychotropic medications that they can prescribe. And that's usually 2 years or 2 to 3 years of additional training with a master's and doctorate. Then they sit for an exam to become accredited, and then they become licensed in their state. And as you mentioned earlier, some of them have autonomy, full licensure without being tied to physician supervision, and that's in 22 states in the District of Columbia, but many states were trying to encourage folks to understand that the more autonomy that psychiatric mental health nurses, the more ability to serve some of the rural areas or the other areas that have shortages in psychiatrists.
So for that advanced practice, a psychiatric mental health nurse, what kind of services could they provide to a patient?
So essentially, they can diagnose, treat, do psychotherapy, order diagnostic tests, and of course, the big thing often is the ability to prescribe medications for patients. There is I guess there's about 28,000 psychiatrists in the country, and I think there's a large portion of them that are over 55. So there, we are also trying to encourage people to go into any psychiatric field, of course, but psychiatric nursing is something that people don't always think about because the undergraduate curriculums do not include probably what we would consider enough curriculum in psychiatry and in behavioral health.
Talking to Gail Stern, president of the American Psychiatric Nurses Association, she says, statistics show that we have a shortage of mental health care providers. She says that psychiatric nurses could help fill that gap. And Gail, I think it was in your report I read that you've seen some nursing schools or professors steer people not toward, but away from psychiatric nursing. Has that happened?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it has. I think with the focus on mental health and substance use, certainly the opioid crisis, some of them are starting to relook at that. Now, the American Psychiatric Nurses Association actually has some suggestions and a toolkit for these nursing schools to try to improve, shall we say, the curriculum in psychiatric nursing and hopefully, you know, reach out and have them join our ranks, shall we say. One of the things I wanted to also mention out of the report, so I would steer people to the report that's available on APNA, and I don't know if you can put a link on your website, but there's a shortage of psychiatric mental health nurses in the country, and so that's part of the reason for this, and the other part, so we're looking for recruiting, shall we say, but it is actually an area where if people, when they're going to school, often want to try to find something that they're going to get a job in when they graduate. And there's certainly many vacancies, something like a 58% increase in the vacancies in psychiatric nursing. So there's jobs available for individuals who pursue this this career.
I want to bring on a caller. We've got Judy on the line in Ripon. Judy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I think that this, I'm an RN. I've been an RN for 35 years. I think that this trend of trying to make nurses into doctors is something we have to take with a little bit of caution. Even with advanced practice RNs, you don't get the hard sciences. I mean, the really in-depth pharmacology that physicians get, you just don't. And I really worry anytime somebody says, we need to make these nurses available to go out and treat people without any supervision from a physician. It's the easy answer, and insurance companies love it because it's so much cheaper. But the consumer of mental health or any type of health doesn't understand what they are, what the different levels are involved in nursing or medicine.
Judy, thanks for the call. So an RN saying, hey, let's maybe not turn so many nurses into practitioners, Gail.
Okay, I think one of the things I love about nurses is we are a very responsible group of individuals. So what I would say is I have known very few nurses that would perform services that they did not feel they were competent in. And if they ran into a situation that they felt was not within their scope to respond to and to care for competently, safely, and legally, they would seek supervision. So I'm not saying we wouldn't seek supervision from physicians or from other colleagues. What the law does is require it absolutely rather than allow that to the, shall we say, professional judgment of the individual nurse.
Thanks for that call, Judy. You mentioned earlier, Gail, the opioid epidemic. Do you see psychiatric nurses having a role in dealing with both addiction and mental health problems that might go along with addiction?
Yeah, currently most of us have competencies in terms of treating individuals, especially dual diagnosis. So often you have a mental illness co-occurring with a substance use disorder. But even for just substance use disorders and opioid abuse, psychiatric nurses are available, both RNs and APRNs, to help with that. One of the services that assists opioid management is called medication-assisted treatment. And many of our psychiatric nurses have gotten the waiver that is necessary in order to provide some of the medication treatments along with the therapy to help individuals wean off of opioids.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Gail, some states allow more or less full autonomy for psychiatric nurses to be practitioners. Many don't. Do you see a trend? Are more states considering this as an option recently?
Well, I think so. I think there's a number of we are an education and research organization, APNA, but we have seen that most states are looking at, you know, what is the appropriate amount of supervision prior to moving a person to autonomy. Some of the states are going to sort of a period of time, like an internship, if you will, before they move them, or some of them are seeing that the we can leave that to the professional judgment of the nurses they come out. And trust me, all nurses that I've seen come out seek supervision. But the mandate of supervision locks them away from some of the areas that they could serve, like rural areas and other, even urban areas that are in need.
We'll leave it there for now. Gail, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Gail Stern, president of the American Psychiatric Nurses Association. She's currently administrator of the Department of Psychiatry for Lehigh Valley Health Network in Pennsylvania. She joined us to make the case that psychiatric mental health nurses could help address a projected shortage in mental health professionals in Wisconsin and around the country. In Wisconsin, only doctors can currently prescribe hormonal birth control. Under new proposed legislation, that could change. Earlier this month, Republican lawmakers put forth a bill that would allow pharmacists to also prescribe hormonal birth control. Mary Falskowski is one of those lawmakers. She's a Republican state representative from Irma. She represents the state's 35th Assembly District. Representative Falskowski, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, can you tell us why you saw a need for this legislation?
So one of the things that we witness not only in Wisconsin, but in the United States as a whole is unplanned pregnancies. And the result of unplanned pregnancies, especially in our lower income families and in young women, you know, a lot of times that unplanned pregnancy prevents them from finishing their education or even starting a higher education. Children or young women that have unplanned pregnancies are more likely to live their lives in poverty and not be able to get out of that. So what we looked at is the parameters of what constitutes why a prescription drug would be only used through a prescription and not be allowed to be prescribed through a pharmacist. And the birth control back in, you know, the 60 years ago had a much higher dosage of estrogen or hormones in it, and it was a little bit harder on the system, so we needed to have a doctor monitor it. That has came down drastically since it was first developed. And now over 100 other countries around the world allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control, as well do many other states. So we felt this was a time to introduce it and make it more available to those that wanted it.
Now, generally for a prescription medication, you go to a doctor or a nurse practitioner in some cases. For an over-the-counter drug, you can buy it right out of the pharmacy. This would be a middle category. So on a practical level, how would this work? What would someone do to obtain this pharmacist-given prescription?
So when you go in there, you do answer a medical questionnaire given to you by the pharmacist. And then they do blood pressure scans, and they answer that. We then, in our legislation, require that medical questionnaire and the result of the blood pressure be transmitted to your primary care physician if you have one. And then the pharmacists would make the recommendation and give you the drug based on medical questionnaire and blood pressure. And if there's any red flags in there, he or she has the right to deny you and suggest that you do see a physician.
And who would this cover? Are there any age restrictions in your bill?
Yes, it is. This is for adults, so it's for those that are 18 and older. Now, we have been asked to consider a friendly amendment that with parental consent for 16 to 18, and that is being talked about right now in our caucus.
Talking to Mary Fels. Go ahead.
It would be through parental consent.
Talking to Mary Felskowski, Assembly Representative from Irma, talking about legislation she co-authored that would allow pharmacists to prescribe hormonal birth control. Representative Melissa Sargent, a Democrat, has pointed out she's sponsored similar legislation in the past. She's reintroduced that now. She says your bill doesn't go far enough to ensure access. She's worried about the age restriction. She wants to include more kinds of birth control, some training for pharmacists, and more. How do you compare and contrast with her past legislation?
So one of the things when we were looking at this, and, you know, we looked at a lot of the different legislation amongst the states, I think when you go too young on that, I do think that young women should, you know, they should have their parents involved in it, as well as probably should see a physician at a very young age. So we are looking at the amendment, as I said, from 16 and 18, because I think parents, it's very important to keep parents in the mix of raising their children and having some, you know, moms need to be talking to their daughters. And this is one more way that, you know, the daughters need to approach the moms, and they need to be having healthy conversations. In addition to that, we have the requirement that the pharmacist does report back to the primary care physician if that's given on the medical questionnaire or the primary care clinic. Maybe you see a Spira's clinic and a number of different providers, so that it goes into your medical records. And that was a request that, by the doctors, so that they know when they see you the next time what you're, what's been prescribed to you in case there's an emergency room visit, because medications do combine. So that is the primary differences in our bills. I know Melissa has, Representative Sargent has put this bill out before, as you had said, and she would just pretty much take the age limit off it, and we do have that age limit on there.
Have you heard from pharmacists on this? Is this something they want to be doing?
Every pharmacist in my district that I've talked to 100% supports this, and I'm pretty sure the pharmacists have backed this legislation. Yes.
What have you heard from fellow Republicans in the legislature about whether they support this bill?
Well, you know, I think people are thinking it through. You know, we're such a society of go to the doctor, get the prescription, you know, like even certain prescriptions, Zyrtec or other ones used to be, you know, prescription drugs, and now they're over the counter. So I think some of them we've had good sign on. I think we have 15 or 20 co-sponsors so far. In our assembly caucus, I'm not quite sure what it is in the Senate. And then, you know, I've been talking to different legislators and answering questions. We had a brief caucus discussion on it this week. I think people are just kind of thinking through the thought of, you know, taking a prescription drug and making it non-prescription. And, you know, sometimes you got to just think through all of the parameters that surround that. But so far, the support's been very good.
Now, the bill comes at a time when state lawmakers are considering bills related to abortion in the state, including what's been called the Born Alive measure. Do you see your bill fitting into this as something that could help reduce the demand, the interest in abortions in the first place?
Absolutely. You know, the more that we can reduce unplanned pregnancies, the more we can stop abortions from happening. Abortions have consequences not only for that unborn child, but also a lot of time for the woman that decides to make that decision. You know, numerous times you'll hear that it comes back and it, you know, it's a factor, you know, surrounding them for the rest of their life. So anything we can do to take that away. But what I'm really worried about is young women getting caught up with not graduating or not going on to college and getting pigeonholed in a life of poverty or very low employment and not being able to have a quality, happy life where they're reaching their full potential. Families are so much more successful. Young women are so much more successful if they wait to have their children in a planned atmosphere instead of unplanned. So this is about quality of life for people also.
As we wrap up, we talked about Republican support for this. Do you think you'll get bipartisan support, potentially even from the governor who'd have to sign off on this?
I do. I think, you know, I don't think that our caucus is where Melissa's at with no age restriction on that. I think that would be very hard for a caucus to support. So I do think that Representative Kitchens and my version of the bill will move forward. And I'm hoping at that time that my Democratic colleagues come on to the bill, even if they would rather have Melissa's. This is kind of a compromise. And if we can do the friendly amendment to take it down to 16 with parental consent, we're kind of striking a happy medium. And then, yes, I do hope Governor Evers, because Governor Evers has said that one of the places we can come together on is health care. And I fully agree with that. He's done some other things in the budget, like with around dental therapy that we introduced last session. So I know that we're on the same track around healthcare and healthcare access. So I do think, I haven't talked to the governor's office, but I do think that this would be something he would support.
Representative Felskowski, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Have a great weekend.
That's Mary Felskowski, Republican state representative from Irma. She represents the state's 35th Assembly District. She was with us to talk about a new bill she's co-authoring that would allow pharmacists in Wisconsin to prescribe hormonal birth control. A confidential legal memo from the IRS said that President Trump's tax returns would have to be turned over to Congress unless the president decided to invoke executive privilege. Executive privilege has been floated as a possibility on other occasions throughout President Trump's administration, notably around the release of the redacted Mueller report and subpoenas for current and former White House staff. But while the president has the power to withhold information for the sake of the public good, it's rarely invoked by the executive branch. Our next guest is here to explain more about the process and how it's been used historically. Paul Nolet is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the nutshell of what executive privilege is.
So executive privilege is essentially the ability of the president to shield information from the other branches of government, including Congress, the courts, and more generally to the public, using arguments of either national security or to protect sensitive communications within the executive branch.
A key issue in a lot of the current debates between the president and Congress is who gets this privilege of executive privilege. Does it apply just to the president, to senior aides? How far does it extend out?
Yeah, and that's a big question. And I should say at the outset that one of the reasons why there are so many of these questions left open is that despite the fact that executive privilege has been part of American law going back to the George Washington administration, the phrase itself and the concept of executive privilege does not exist in the Constitution. So the Constitution doesn't give any easy answers here. Now, I think in response to the specific question that you asked, I think most, even though courts haven't directly addressed this issue, most legal observers would say that it would have to be the president who invokes executive privilege. In other words, if there was another member of the executive branch who was called to testify in front of Congress, they themselves couldn't say, well, I invoke executive privilege. It would have to be the president on their behalf.
Now, here's a weird twist on that, though. We've had members of the president's cabinet testifying before Congress saying they're going to decline to answer that question because even though the president hadn't invoked executive privilege on that issue, they didn't want to halt. They didn't want to stop his opportunity to do that. So kind of preemptively saying the president could invoke executive privilege on this issue, so I can't step on that here.
Yeah, it's a way of sort of having it both ways, where you don't try to claim that as an executive branch member who's not the president, you're not claiming that you have executive privilege, but at the same time, you're declining to answer what Congress is looking for. And even though the president hasn't declared it or invoked executive privilege. So it's a somewhat of a rhetorical strategy, I think, to avoid giving Congress what they want without raising some serious legal issues at the same time.
Some of the sticky issues lately are, again, over the issue of who it applies to. And when you have, say, Congress saying that Don McGahn, a former legal counsel to the president, shouldn't be protected under executive privilege, and the White House potentially saying he should, or a communications director like Hope Hicks, or a deputy counsel. Those are all possibilities. If Congress says, yeah, the White House says no, then what?
Well, then it gets to the courts, and they're put in a pretty sticky situation. In fact, Anthony Kennedy, former justice, in a case back in the 2000s in the W. Bush administration, mentioned how when exactly what you described just happens, when Congress says one thing and the president invokes executive privilege, you have two branches of government on a collision course with one another. And it can be really difficult for the courts to step in and adjudicate that. But they will be called upon to do that, particularly if Trump becomes even more aggressive beyond even the Mueller report, like with the tax returns. If he's more aggressive invoking executive privilege, the courts will get involved and they'll have to address these issues.
Yeah. How much has President Trump specifically invoked executive privilege in response to Congress versus saying that the subpoena isn't or doesn't merit a response or a lawsuit to block the release of financial documents? How often is he actually invoking executive privilege?
So the official, in terms of officially invoking executive privilege, it's only happened with the Mueller investigation and the redactions to this point. He's threatened to invoke it on numerous occasions, even in fact, going back to 2007 when the Mueller investigation first began. He was saying, well, I'm going to invoke executive privilege to prevent people from testifying or at least communicating with the Mueller investigators. But in fact, he didn't do that. So this was the first time that he officially invoked the privilege, although he has said on multiple occasions as well, well, I'm just going to ignore this subpoena. So that also raises some issues that even if you don't officially invoke executive privilege, if essentially your actions are doing that, does that raise the same legal issues as if the president was invoking executive privilege? So it's another thorny legal issue that has no easy answers.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at executive privilege, what it means for this president, past presidents, and what happens when Congress and the White House disagree over what it is and what it means. And Paul, the current players on this stage are Republican President Trump and Democrats in the House. It isn't always that way. Executive branches often are trying to shield themselves from congressional oversight in one way or another, right?
Absolutely. And this goes back to George Washington, in fact, who didn't use the phrase executive privilege, but tried to shield documents from the very first congressional investigation during the course of his presidency. So presidents of different political parties have invoked the privilege before. In fact, Bill Clinton did this during the Watergate investigation as well. Rather the Whitewater investigation, excuse me,
right,
as well as the Monica Lewinsky investigation. And President Obama invoked executive privilege in another scandal, the Fast and Furious scandal, which actually led the House of Representatives to hold Eric Holder, the attorney general, in contempt when he refused to turn over documents. So this is something that is not a partisan thing in the sense that there's one party president who is using these claims. It's very much a claim, an invocation that variety of presidents have used over the years.
Let's bring on a caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. One of the things that Congress, or at least the Democrats, need to realize is that Trump is challenging everything all the way up and through to the Supreme Court. And he realizes that the Democrats or the House of Representatives, they have no legal enforcement department. They don't have a sheriff's department. They don't have anybody that can lock up anyone. Even if they put a subpoena on and one of Trump's members denies their request for information or is in violation of the subpoena, so what if they tack on $500 a day for violation of the subpoena? Either the Trump will pay it or the RNC will pay it on their behalf. Trump is taking everything to the Supreme Court, and even if the Supreme Court rules against Trump, they have no enforcement agency.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. So, Paul, Congress toothless, Mike says, even potentially the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right in some regards. I mean, there's a lot of things that have already been brought up, in fact, that executive branch members and the president can do to try to avoid dealing with Congress by refusing to answer questions and ignoring subpoenas and that sort of thing. Of course, if the House of Representatives does go to the courts, then they do win in court, in the lower courts, and then eventually in the Supreme Court level, it's going to put a lot of political pressure, if nothing else, on Trump to comply. And in fact, this is what happened with Richard Nixon in the Watergate investigation when the Supreme Court unanimously said, hey, Nixon, you can't invoke executive privilege here. You have to turn over the tapes. And he did so, and then he resigned shortly after. So I think the key here is not so much, you know, a $500 fine per day or something like that, which will just get paid by somebody else, but rather it's the political pressure that'll build if Trump tries to ignore the courts.
There's been concern over the years that the balance of power on many issues has shifted from Congress toward the executive branch, toward the president. When it comes to executive privilege and congressional oversight, do you think that's been the case? Have presidents over time been subject to less relevant oversight?
Well, actually, there's been more oversight from Congress over time. I agree with the broader point, absolutely, that power has flowed from Congress to the presidency when it comes to war powers, when it comes to many other things as well. But when it comes to investigations, the courts, particularly since U.S. v. Nixon, the Watergate case, have been clear that the president is not above the law and that the president cannot invoke an absolute executive privilege, just kind of utter the magic words and all investigations go away. In fact, the courts have said, no, Congress is a co-equal branch of government and they have a right to information and so do the courts. So the courts balance that with the fact that the president has legitimate arguments for some executive privilege as well, but it's not anything goes. And in fact, if anything, you could argue over the last few decades since Watergate, the courts have been skeptical of the broadest claims that presidents have made about their immunity from the legal process.
Briefly, Paul, as we wrap up, what is the next bit of information you're watching for in about 30 seconds?
I think the big thing is to what extent Trump actually invokes executive privilege across a bunch of different areas. And then we're just going to have to wait and see as sometimes lengthy litigation crawls through the courts. And I think it's almost inevitable, I think, the way that things are going, that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to weigh in one way or another on one of these big, complicated issues.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at executive privilege, what it is, how it's been used in the past, and how it could be making news in the coming weeks as the potential fight over President Trump's tax returns and subpoenas of current and former Trump administration officials plays out in Washington, D.C. You can share your thoughts on executive privilege and the latest in the standoff between the president and Congress. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I was looking at the internets earlier today, and up on Twitter is this picture of a city block with lots and lots of colorful umbrellas hanging in the air. On further inspection, that city was Wausau. Turns out it's an annual tradition on 3rd Street in downtown Wausau. For some firsthand information, we've got former Wausonian Jana Rose Schleiss, producer for The Morning Show. Hey, Jana Rose.
Hey, Rob.
So you've actually seen this up in action, right?
Yeah, definitely. I lived on the next block, next to 3rd Street in Wausau, so I walked past these umbrellas every day.
Was this a popular spot for people to come and visit?
Oh my gosh, yes. It was a huge photo op. there's a lot of festivals and events that happen in downtown Wausau, so you will see those umbrellas in the background and everybody's selfies.
Did you ever get a selfie yourself?
Of course.
Okay, we should probably share that with our listeners at some point. This is through the summer. It's going up in late May. It's up through the summer. Is this some much-needed shade on a hot August day in Wausau?
It does kind of create a checkerboard of shade as you walk under them on really sunny days, but I don't think it'll help you if it's actually raining.
Now, wait a minute. This is a street with sidewalks and cars.
Yep.
So for those selfies, do people have to dodge out during breaks in the traffic?
Kind of. People are in the crosswalks lingering to get photos of these. But they really add a lot to 3rd Street where everybody's shopping and eating.
Jenna Rose, thanks a lot for painting us a picture.
Thank you, Rob.
This is Central Time. You can stand under my umbrella. You can stand